Good morning, everyone. My name is Elaine McDowell, and I'm a Class A trustee emeritus. And if you know a little bit of Latin, you know that when it becomes into the female gender, it's emerita. So I'm the first trustee emerita of the General Service Board, and I really want to welcome all of you to this particular session. With that having been stated, I just really, really want to welcome all of you to the session on AA and the alcoholism field. And I know that many of you know our literature so well, and that Bill spoke so highly of the fact in the early years and throughout our history, the major importance that Friends of AA have played in the development and the continuation of our wonderful fellowship, because it's our professional friends who many times have opened the doors for AA and help us reach the still suffering alcoholic. And this morning, we have three wonderful friends of Alcoholics Anonymous as well. And so without further ado, I want to bring them forward and have them just talk for about 20 minutes. And the first person that I will be introducing is Dr. Keith Humphreys, who's a professor at Stanford University. Please give Keith a really, really warm welcome.
Morning. Thank you for that nice welcome, and thank you for honoring me by letting me to come to your meeting of this incredible fellowship that's taught me so much over the years. I go to a lot of conventions. This one is definitely different in ways that are really fun and exciting. I see guys I'd probably walk around if I saw them on the street, hugging each other and speaking such warmth and gentleness. It's really inspiring. In fact, something even stranger was when I got here a couple nights ago, very late, my flight was delayed, and I didn't have time to eat, so I went down to the hotel restaurant, very late to get some food. And as I walked in, I looked into the bar. First time in my life, I've been in a hotel late at night and seen that the only person in the bar who looked sad was the bartender. I almost wanted to go over and tell him it would be okay. There'd be other conventions. His kids could still go to college and, it'd be all right. But anyway, I'm a researcher and a clinician. I've worked taking care of people who've had addiction problems. I've done some studies of treatment. Normally, I put up lots of slides and graphs and charts, I'm not going to do that here, and I think you'll be glad for that. Someone said, it's AA, Keith, you got to let your hair down. And I so wish I could, but I can't do that. But I thought instead of doing my normal shtick, I'll just tell you a story about how I learned about AA and what it's meant to me as a professional. I got my first job in this field maybe about 20 years ago in Detroit, Lower East Side of Detroit. And what my job was, I was working for a medical school in the state, and we were trying to figure out when that treatment worked. So I would meet people when they came into treatment, and then I was supposed to find them 6 months later wherever they were. People with alcohol problems, people with drug problems. Now, this job was somewhat dangerous. Some people, when they leave treatment, unfortunately, are not able to stay clean and sober. And at 6 months, they're in a variety of situations, a variety of housing options, so to speak. And so they didn't want people to go out alone on this job, so they paired us all the time with people. So I'm new. It's my new job. I want to do well. First week, I'm paired with this guy named Mike. And we come to this one neighbor, and I say, Mike, I think this neighbor is a little dangerous. Are you sure we should go here? And he says, well, look, we're just going to have to turn that over. And I say, okay, great. Thinking, I don't know what he just said, but It's a new job, and I just better play along here. So I spent a week with Mike. He's a nice guy. We find a lot of people, talk to him. Next week, my second person I'm paired with is named Carl. Carl's from Detroit. And, I said, I've never been in this agency before, and I've never talked in my life to someone who's used heroin. I'm not sure I can, because Keith's got to take it till you make it. So, okay. That's great. So I spent the intervening weekend thinking, okay, what's going on here? I mean, Mike, he told me, he barely got out of high school. He lives in rural Michigan. He's totally like Carl's, and Carl lives in the city. Carl's got a master's degree. He's more intellectual. What is this connection? So the third week, we all have lunch together, and then it's just really awful because, they'd say, don't take someone's inventory, and, it's a let go and let God, man, and, gratitude and your attitude. And they're like, okay, I can't take this anymore. I've been working with you guys for 2 weeks. I think we've got a pretty good relationship. So I'm going to ask you a question, and forgive me, but are you Masons? And they said, no, we're not Masons. I go, is it Amway salesman, CIA operatives? What is it? He goes, no, we're in AA. And not wanting to appear uncool, so I'm like, hey, yeah. You know, my car battery died once, you guys. And it's a great organization. He goes, no, Alcoholics Anonymous. I go, what is that? So they tell me what it is. I remember now I'm 20 years old, and I think I'm going to become a doctor someday. So I hear all this. I say, so let me make sure I understand this. You guys are alcoholics. You go in church basements and civic centers and the back room of libraries, and you sit with other alcoholics without medical supervision, and you think this is going to get you better. And they say, yeah, that's right. And I, you know, with the kind of open-minded spirit of youth, I'm like, wow, that's crazy. That's just absolutely crazy. You've got to be kidding. Now, why did I react that way? You could say, well, it's partly because, you know, you were a young, snobby guy, and I don't like that explanation. It's too accurate. But part of it was clearly because I was learning how to be a professional. And there's a lot of neat stuff you learn when you get trained professional, but there's some bad stuff you learn explicitly or implicitly. And one of the things is that, you know, life is just not very good without professionals. And, you know, the more professionals there are, the more psychiatrists, more psychologists, the better life is, and we can do everything, that kind of thing. And I'm so lucky I ran into AA before I got too far into that system. Because, you know, arrogance is not a flaw unique to alcoholics. It's all over the place. And, you know, Mike and Carl very nicely took me to open meetings and told me about the big book and all that stuff. And then probably just as important to me, because, you know, I'm really interested in science, it made a big difference that in the study when we looked at who was doing better 6 months later, you know, you could say there's a lot of reasons why people do better or worse in addiction treatment, but the biggest reason in our study was those who got involved in a 12-step fellowship after treatment tended to be clean and sober, and those who didn't were not. And that had a big impression on me. Let me turn the volume up. I'll turn my own volume up. How about that? I'll do my best. Can you hear me in the back? Okay. If I tail off, let me know. So anyway, I'm grateful for that. I mean, it's kind of like recovering from professionalism, if I can use that analogy. And I do try to carry that principle forward and that message and train new people going into the field that way. I mean, you know, if you're a med student at my university, you've heard me say, I want every physician, every future physician, to learn 2 foreign language phrases. And those are, I don't know, and I'm sorry. I got so interested in self-help, I actually spent the next, or mutual health fellowships, I spent the next 10 or 15 years studying them and learning about them and trying to tell other people about what I learned in this country and in the United States and Europe and Asia and so on. And I just want to tell you a little about what I learned I thought might be interesting. We're all in our own countries about what goes on in other places, if you don't know. I wrote a book last year called Circles of Recovery. It summarizes all this, and every single person who works for me told me it was great. So I'll just tell you a few things we found. I mean, the first one, it's just amazing. Alcoholics Anonymous is the most sought source of help for alcohol problems on the planet Earth. And, you know, the triennial survey shows, you know, you know how it is. You get it when meeting. There's about 1.1 million people in the United States and Canada, maybe about 2.4 in the world. But the number of people who have contact in AA is far bigger than that, because the triennial survey tells you what happens in one moment in time. And there's some wonderful studies where they do national population surveys would probably tell you that the number of people seek help from AA each year for alcohol problems is at least double what it says in the triennial survey, at least, maybe more. So that means something like, you know, this year, 5 million people somewhere on this planet will reach out to AA for help. And that is an extraordinarily impressive and wonderful thing. And we saw at that incredible ceremony last night that the reach of that number is just going to go up because of the way AA is growing in places like India, as we saw in that great talk last night. Second thing, you know, we found in this research, it's not going to surprise any of you, but a certain amount of research is about, you know, getting a battering ram to knock down a door that was unlocked anyway. So, but the study we found that people who got involved in AA were more likely to stay sober. That's been found in pretty much every country where it's been studied. German studies, Japanese studies, Italian studies, French studies. And what's remarkable about that is it's very few things in the addiction field that work in so many places. There are many things that seem to work somewhere that don't work somewhere else. And it's amazing and wonderful that AA seems to work all over the place. Another point I think might be interested, hopefully to everybody, but at least particularly to the women in the room. What I found when I was studying AA in different countries is AA is booming among the world's women. For example, in Japan, there used to be another fellowship called Denshukai, which is more traditional. Men and women always went together. Man spoke first, women spoke second. Now that AA is there, a lot of women are finding they'd rather go to AA than that. It's happening in Switzerland. It's happening in Austria. A lot of women are going into it. And there's something so interesting to think about. How is it that, Ohio is a great state. I stood there when I was a kid. But I don't think of, like, 1930s Ohio as a bastion of feminist thought or anything. You know, how did these two guys, Bill and Bob, make up a program that now about a third of the people are women? And I think something quite unusual about AA, special about it, is that even though it was founded by two men, what does it say? You know, stop being so selfish, stop being so arrogant, be nice to other people, be emotionally aware, make amends when you do harm. I think a lot of wives would sign their husbands up for this very quickly. Ad hoc, and that it embraces those, we think of often as feminine values, and that's something that I think will increase its appeal all over. The last thing that so impresses me about AA when I look over is just how adaptable it is, how practical you all are in making the decision that the purpose is to get sober and keep other people sober, and all the other stuff, is negotiable. So if you go out to the western part of this country, there are native peoples who use AA and they incorporate all their native spirituality right into the meeting. And people go to meetings as families. In most of the world it's single, but their family's everything. People go as a family. Like, well, that's very strange. It's unusual, but people are getting sober, staying sober, so we'll take it. Down in Mexico, there are AA meetings where they have paintings up front of Bob and Bill, and people light candles, kind of like they grew up with in the Catholic Church. Well, that's very different, too, but people are getting sober, staying sober, so that we're going to take that, too. Okay, how are we doing there? All right. Thank you. I have a friend who studied AA meetings in Marin County, which is kind of it's slightly north of San Francisco. It's like I can't describe it. It's like Disneyland crossed with the yogurt store or something. Okay? But anyway, up there, she said there's an AA meeting held out on a yacht, and you have to like weave through all these BMWs and Lexuses in the parking lot, and then there's all this granola and celery sticks laid out up front, an ice sculpture that says AA, and everybody's covering the lawyer. And I think, well, that's totally different than Mexico. That's totally different than Native peoples. But that people are getting sober, so we'll take it. And just the last thing, it's been my privilege this last year to be working with Charlie Curie and other wonderful people at SAMHSA in the Middle East on building up mental health systems. And I was so excited to see the flags from Bahrain and Saudi Arabia last night. Your sister society, Narcotics Anonymous, had a meeting in Tehran last year, and 10,000 people came. So, and it's so great to present AA over there because everybody says, well, I don't know, can we afford it? I go, yeah, it'll fit in the budget really comfortably. In fact, I can personally get you 10% off. It's going to take a lot of adaptation over there, different languages, different culture, different religious background and all that, but it'll happen because, again, the final decision is what gets people sober, we're in favor of that, and the rest of it is all negotiable. And that's something I just love about AA is I believe in professional treatment. I think we should offer it to people. I've evaluated. I've offered it myself. But we're just never going to be as flexible as all of you guys can be. And I think that's why you're able to reach way more people than treatment ever reaches, than I'll ever reach in my career. And that's one of the many reasons I'm grateful to this organization for the wisdom that you've had. So thank you so much for letting me part.
That was just terrific, Keith. Thank you so very much. And now it gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce a friend of mine, Dr. Louise Sadeau, who is professor of psychology here in this wonderful country of Canada at the University of Montreal. Louise.
Well, good morning, everybody. I'm delighted to be here. It's really an honor to be here, and last night was such a moving ceremony. It's difficult to put it into words, and since my first language is not English, I am wordless, but the emotion was extremely powerful, and to see more or less 40,000 people there all humming together was extraordinary. I was also absolutely delighted to hear my colleague Humphrey, Dr. Humphrey, speak. I don't think I'll be as funny as he am. I'm very sorry about that, so you'll have to, because I thought I would prepare... Since Elaine, you know, this is about academia and all that, I thought I would prepare a profound academic speech. I hope to get the Nobel Prize out of it. So I thought I would speak about the field of alcoholism before AA and after AA. Keep it simple. So, how was it before? It's a nice story, and it's at the same time a horrific story. The story, I guess, starts in North America with this guy. There was this physician working in the Army, the U.S. Army, and he had been there during the war, and in 1785, he wrote this book. And his name was Benjamin Rush. I always thought to be called Benjamin Rush when you're writing a book about alcoholism is quite a feat. So Dr. Rush wrote this book, and he spoke about the thermometer of intemperance, intemperance. And that thermometer was quite powerful. It spoke about the progression of alcoholism, 1785. And he described this. He said, well, people just start drinking, and then it becomes a habit, and then it becomes a necessity. And the notion of addiction was really coined there, this notion of necessity. And then he spoke about this idea that the pickle can never re-become a cucumber, which is such a great statement. I actually wrote in this French encyclopedia, I need to tell you this anecdote, Larousse, which is a French edition, they write all these great dictionaries and all that, were writing this dictionary on psychology. So they asked me to write this thing about alcoholism. So I wrote it, and then I spoke about AA and said, you know, I told the story, alcoholism before AA, after AA, patat, patat, and I do that. And then at one point, now this guy is a real academic, runs this encyclopedia, I'd say, and then I wrote, basically the whole idea is that the cucumber, the pickle will never be able to become a cucumber. Now I write this in this encyclopedia, I said, he's going to cut me off. So he answers back, he's in Paris, I'm in Montreal, he says, the best part of your article is about pickles and cucumbers. So if you ever read Le Dictionnaire de Psychologie aux Éditions Larousse, and you'll find pickles and cucumbers. So this guy, Benjamin Rush, writes this book. And he basically thinks two things. He thinks that alcoholism is a disease that progresses, that becomes a necessity. He also says that unless you stop drinking, people become mad or die. In the thermometer, it's written madness and death. And that book had enormous impact, but it had impact in a way that probably wouldn't have expected. There were two ways for it to go. Or it could move and feed in the temperance and prohibitionist movement, or it could feed in to have an understanding of addiction as a necessity for a human being to drink that had nothing to do with will. But that's not the way it went. The way it was understood was as a moral issue. And during the whole 19th century, the battle was around eliminating alcohol in North America. And that battle took place also in Europe, because at the same time, the work of Benjamin Rush very, very rapidly was known throughout the world. He actually was a member of this Royal Society of Science in the UK. And folks in the UK also were writing about alcoholism, very fine scholars. And everybody agreed that it was a disease. But that's not how things went. Things went into moralizing the issue of alcohol. Concretely, what that means. That means that if you're drunk, there's two options. Or you're a sinner, and you have to repent. And a lot of the work that was written by William James when he told the stories of people that were in missions were stories about repentance. Of course, major conversions, but repentance. The other option is that you're a criminal. And in the 19th century, there was two places to go if you were a drunkard that didn't stop drinking. You went to prison, or you went into the backwards of asylums. And there were lots and lots of asylums in the 19th century, enormous buildings. And when you entered those asylums, it was for a long, long time. The other problem with having temperance and prohibitionist movement was that there was no place for treatment. And when, in fact, the guy who trained William Silkworth was this physician who was working in a hospital in New York, at the Bellevue Hospital, I think. This guy, when he wanted to start a unit to treat alcoholics, found nothing in the English literature. He had to go in the American literature, I'm sorry. He had to go in the English literature to dig out work that was done by an English physician in 1866. So there was nothing there, which meant concretely that there was no help around. And when Bill started to think, how can I get alcoholics to change, and how that became his life obsession. as he was in treatment at Charlestown's hospital trying to figure out what would work, there was very, very little around. In fact, it's clear that the AA movement got to know the work of Benjamin Rush. Was it through the works of Benjamin Rush? I don't know. But the ideas of progression, the ideas of madness and death that would take place if one kept on drinking, the whole notion that abstinence was the only way out, all those ideas fed in the AA tradition, and I'm not too sure it was through the work of the book that Benjamin Rush had written or those ideas. But certainly the whole notion was there. And when Bill was trying to figure out the how, going with the Oxford Group movement and listening to Silkworth, who would repeat to him that it was a disease and it was an allergy, and then telling him also that the most powerful changes in people's lives were spiritual experiences. And that's really important, because the guys in the 19th century felt you had to repent because you were a sinner. And when Bill tried to tackle that idea, he said, no, this is not what we're talking about. We're talking about a divided self, a person who behaves in a way that he himself disapproves. And I'll always remember this inmate with whom I was working in a Canadian prison who told me very simply, Louise, when I lie to my wife, when I betray the loved ones because I'm drinking, that's not really me. The real me is a different person. And I myself despise and hate that person that's within me. But when I'm drinking, that's what takes place. And that was written in William James about the divided self and how only a powerful spiritual experience can make that divided self become one. And that can only be achieved through abstinence. That was a complete different discourse than what was going on in repentance and what was going on when you said you were a sinner that had to pay for your sins. A complete different thing. So the 19th century was a very, very bad time. If you look, I know more being a Francophone, I know what was going on also in France. And in France, even though the temperance movement was very different because people were growing wine and the idea of having a France without alcohol and without wine just simply didn't enter their minds, so those temperance movements just weren't very popular. It took place a little bit different, so it's a different story. And even then, the psychiatrists were trained by saying that alcoholics were perverts. I mean, it's really how it was. And I have this dear colleague of mine who's a psychiatrist who's 75 years old, and that's how he was trained before the Second World War. It's not that far in time. So that was the setting. AA arrived, let's say, in 1935. And suddenly this whole notion of the disease concept of alcoholism takes place. And when you're looking at the field of alcoholism, there's the before and there's the after. And the cutting date, the year zero in the field, is 1935. So there's the Old Testament and the New Testament. At that time, there were some people working in the field of alcoholism who saw that. There was a bunch of folks working at Yale University around one of their leaders. There were a lot of people. They were a big team. One of them was Jelinek. And Dr. Jelinek thought that AA had a pretty good idea and that he could start rethinking studies of alcohol around those ideas. And the Yale Center for Alcohol Studies started around that whole idea of the disease model. This was largely borrowed to the fellowship. In 1960, he wrote this extraordinary book that had an importance throughout the world. It was called The Disease Concept of Alcoholism. That book today is probably not considered scientifically exact. We've moved in the field in enormous ways. So that book right now is probably not considered scientifically sound. But those ideas change the whole services in the world in interaction with AA. I'll speak about Quebec, which I know exactly nearly month by month how things change. The AA movement arrives in Quebec in 1947. With an Anglophone called Dave. At that point in the English community, we call them Anglophones, it's easier, because English means the Queen and the UK, and we get upset. So, so we call them Anglophones. So in the Anglophone community, i.e. Protestant, the AA movement had lots of impact. In the Francophone community, French-speaking Catholic, this idea that you would understand God, Dieu tel qu'on le comprend, God as you understand him, just didn't fit right with the priests and the vicars. They thought that they wanted God as we understand him. So it took what was called the Tranquil Revolution in Quebec. That took place around in the 60s. All the church got emptied and all the AA meetings started. And it's exactly that, believe it or not. It was as simple as that. And because before that, the temperance movement had their groups for people that were drinking, and you had lifetime pledges of abstinence. So my cousins were age 3, they had never drank, and they had the pledge. It was crazy. And because they didn't discriminate between who needed not to drink and who probably didn't need to have such a stringent rapport to alcohol. So in the 60s, AA starts in the Francophone community. And at the same time, it's the time when services are built. And here you have in Quebec the exact little, it's a little environment in which you have the old ideas about alcoholism being wicked. The moral model saying some people are evil and sinners and others are not. And the disease model in which you say some people have some difficulty with alcohol. They have a disease. It's them. It's not others. They need help. And never look down on a drunk. And you see the battle. And, of course, the good side won. And all the systems in Quebec, you saw the change from moving to a moral model to the disease model, using the ideas of Jelinek, using the ideas of AA, to develop a whole treatment setting built on the disease model. The same revolution took place in France. It took place a little later with one physician that was called Pierre Fouquet, who wrote, very much inspired by the AA model, very much inspired also by the work of Jelinek. And that really changed the lives of families. It changed the lives of people that were in difficulty. So the before and after is black and white in our field. I would just like to speak about... I won't go into what AA did to my life. Maybe I can speak about that a little bit. Well, it changed my life on an everyday basis, so I try to always repeat to myself, first things first. Then, of course, I tried to improve myself daily and to move forward. Because one of the things you learn in AA is that every day you have this challenge of trying to stay sober. And to stay sober always means also that you have to make good decisions on values and on ethics. And to behave in a way that when you go to bed in the evening, you feel that it's the true self that has behaved, not the false self. And that certainly is the main guideline. But I want to look now at what is our field in year 2000 as we're moving into understanding alcoholism with neurosciences. When Bill went into treatment at the Charlestown Hospital, and Silkworth told him, alcoholism is an allergy to alcohol, that paper was published in 1932, and it's probably not correct. Even today, we consider it's a metaphor. But what that idea said, and what has been there in the fellowship, is that people are not created equal. When it gets to alcohol, some people are different. Some people are more vulnerable. In the fellowship, we say some people have the disease. For scientists, that wasn't specific enough. And if we move from what works to what's the scientific data, right now there's a whole bunch of scientists working in molecular biology, working in genetics. They're basically working with rats. Right. And rats are not people. But rats just love alcohol. They do. And there's several monkeys also who think that drinking is great. And then, of course, what you can do with rats, what you can't do with human beings, is you can knock them out, i.e. you take a little gene here and you just take it out. And then you see, do they drink, do they enjoy more drinking or enjoy less drinking? And then you can take these drinking rats and look at their ADN, how their genes are built. And you see that the patterns of the drinking rats are not the same as the non-drinking rats. And right now we understand that not all rats are created equal when it gets to alcohol. And we're getting pretty good with monkeys also. So you can do those things. You have these monkeys and you actually have, there's a whole colony of alcoholic monkeys in the Caribbean. They're in St. Kitts, in fact. So you have, you know, all these generations of drinking monkeys. They had sugar cane over there. And then when you have sugar cane, it becomes, and you leave it rot there, it becomes alcohol. So you have this whole generation of alcoholic monkeys. And a scientist said, what a good idea to study alcohol. So you have all these bunch of monkeys. Some of them had great-great-great-grandfathers that were alcoholics, and others were protected. And they started looking at genetic makeup of all these individuals. And what we're realizing is that there is such a thing as a biological vulnerability to alcohol. Right now, we don't have the answer as to what exact gene, what exact number. We're not too clear what's the interaction between what happens when you're small, if your dad is drinking, over and above the fact that that person has transmitted to you alcoholic vulnerability. But this whole idea that some people clearly cannot deal with alcohol, and others, when they take a first drink, experience a rush that's very, very different than the person beside them that's drinking. All those stories we've heard in AA that were told from the perspective of what I felt, what I experienced, not the perspective of a geneticist looking at the makeup, but how people felt it and how that led them to get into an experience that they themselves disapproved and felt that they had no control over that. This is coming out in work. Right now, there's nobody that can pinpoint a trend that's definitive, but certainly the whole corpus of work that is presently being done does indicate that the ideas that were there in the field about not being equal, some people not being able to deal with alcohol, even within the same family, is certainly being verified scientifically. So when you ask the question, what does AA contribute to the field of alcoholism, I would respond to that when you're not clear about a hypothesis, you can generally go back to the body of ideas that are in AA, and lots of those ideas that came from the heart, that came from the experience, that came from Bill that was thinking, what do I need to do to get a bunch of alcoholics sober? He wasn't a scientist. He was asking how, not why. If you're a scientist being paid by the state to answer why, and you have to do that, then you can go back in the AA framework, and you will find many, many, many hypotheses and many good answers. We had to move from allergy to understanding genetically, to understand what goes on in neurotransmitters. We have to work in finding better molecules. All that has to happen. But the general idea that people were not created equal in front of alcohol is an idea right now that stemmed a lot from the work of AA and that right now is being scientifically validated. And it was real important in this field that you had people who reported what they experienced from their subjective, personal point of view and repeat those stories so they're heard by scientists who can then see, well, let's go and check this out in the lab. Let's go and check this out to see if it really works. And that's fantastic. The last thing I want to say is that, of course, AA refuses to have people like Dr. Humphreys come in and evaluate you, because you always said, we don't want these scientists out, please, out. And I can understand that. I have lots of understanding for that thought. But it's real interesting that in our evaluation studies, and these studies being done in the U.S., what systematically comes out is that result. The result that you find in the studies Dr. Humphreys reported, the studies that go on in Quebec, the studies that go on here in Toronto and in Alberta confirm that if a client that's being evaluated a year after that person asks for help, when they're in the fellowship, the probability that's the highest probability that they remain sober, that when we evaluate how their work situation is going, they're doing much better. When you look at how the relationship with family and friends are going, again, there's major amelioration. So in all sectors of life, one measures positive outcomes. And for that, we're all extremely grateful. So AA has been a major revolution. There's a before and after. There's the before and after in the field of alcoholism, and there's the before and after in the lives of people, and not only in the lives of people in the fellowship, but also in the lives of the friends of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would like to thank you for that. Thank you so much for your invitation, and hope to see you soon.
Ah, what a lovely, lovely call. Thank you so much. Ah, that was wonderful, and a wonderful history. It gives me just a great deal of pleasure now to introduce someone from the U.S. government who is part of the Health and Human Services Department. Charlie Curie is the administrator for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA. And that rolls off my tongue very easily because I retired from there. So please welcome Charles Curie, the administrator.
Thank you, Elaine, and it's great to be here. It's wonderful to be here with you, and thank you for your work at SAMHSA and what you do day in and day out. It's also an honor to be here with all of you today to share this platform with Louise and also my very good friend that I've been able to work with through the past few years, Keith Humphreys. Louise was just made the comment about keeping scientists at arm's length and that you have a tendency to do that. I can't imagine what you do with government officials. So I'm especially honored that you're welcome here today. And also, there are those of you in the audience who are also good personal friends and colleagues of mine. It's good to see you here today. I cherish our relationships. There's a lot we're up against in this world, a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, a lot of hurt. And what brings us together today is for us to be the message of what we can do to assume responsibility to assure not only are we taking care of ourselves, but most importantly, we take care of ourselves by taking care of others. And that's, I think, one of the most important messages we need to learn and need to keep in mind, especially those of us that are government officials, as we go about our work and our responsibilities. In many ways, as AA celebrates its 70th anniversary, I view this as the concept of recovery is celebrating its 70th anniversary. One of the reasons I accepted the invitation to join you today is to let you know that the federal government in the United States is trying to get real about recovery, trying to get real about understanding it. I've learned many things since I've come to Washington, and I do have the privilege. I'm a short-termer in Washington. I'm appointed by the president, so I know I'm here only for a short period of time. So there's a lot of work to be done. Actually, I kind of like that, to know that I have a short period of time to get a lot of work done. But I learned a lot. I made the move from Pennsylvania to Washington, because I worked for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania for a while, and learned several lessons when I first came to Washington. The first lesson I learned is the closest parking place I could find was still in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And the biggest parking lot around Washington, D.C. is the Beltway. Because the second thing I learned is that the briefings about the meetings I'm attending in Washington are longer than the meetings I'm going to be attending in Washington. Also, the term imminent, when you say something's going to be imminent in state government, that means 6 months. In the federal government, it means 2 years and a cost overrun. And the most gratifying thing I personally learned in coming to Washington is that there are actually twice as many Republican social workers, because I'm a social worker in Washington, than I realized in the nation. There are eight of us. And it's just an extremely gratifying experience. Nice group of people, too. But seriously, as we try to get real about recovery, I'm pleased to say that the president in his 2003 State of the Union address, and some of you may have caught that, spoke frankly about addiction and the importance of focusing our resources in the right way in partnership to address addiction in the United States. And he talked about addiction in a very matter-of-fact approach. He said, I quote, "Addiction crowds out friendship, ambition, moral conviction, and reduces all the richness of life into a single destructive desire." At that same time, he also announced a new program to help more Americans get the help and intervention they need through Access to Recovery. And I'll talk more about Access to Recovery in just a few minutes. But first, I want to share with you some of the things we're trying to do to operationalize recovery in the federal government. And I tell you, it's a difficult thing to do. Recovery is a messy business. It's not something that you can just say there's one pathway to recovery, and there's certain protocols you follow in treatment, and you find recovery. I think you all know in this room that's not true. And that frustrates bureaucrats to no end, that they can't find just boxes to put things in and try to operationalize such a personal thing, an individualized personal thing such as recovery. But we are focused on getting the message out to America that addiction is like other illnesses in any form from which people can and do recover. We're also focused on you and partnerships, recognizing that day-to-day, it's individuals, and that clearly AA, you not only convey a message, but you are the message. And we need to be thinking in terms of how to make sure your strengths are augmented, and that we work together to assure that people find recovery. Your dedication, your strength, your mission to improving the lives of the people for whom are your members stands as an inspiration to many of us. And you are the reason the quality of life has improved for countless people over the last 70 years. And not only would I say the quality of life, but you also know you're in the business of saving lives. And you're the reason that lives will be saved in the future. And part of my responsibility at the federal level is to help others understand that addiction, what it is, and the impact it has. Because it's something that's not easy to talk about. It's something that's not out there that you could that talk about. There's stigma around the whole issue of addiction, as well as mental illness, which is another illness or disease we address in SAMHSA. And we, I believe, have the responsibility to try and conceptualize recovery, communicate recovery's placement in public policy and public finance. What's refreshing about today is I don't have to explain recovery to you. Many groups I meet with, I have to begin to talk about what is recovery. And you can explain it to me. You can tell me. You can inform the government. In fact, I invite that as we have a dialogue, because it's critical right now. I've often said also in terms of recovery, and the other thing that I feel is exciting is that we're starting to use the concept over this past decade. While recovery has been a concept developing and emerging for 70 years with the AA community, with you, it's about over the past decade there's been discussions about the concept of recovery when it comes to another chronic illness called mental illness, and the idea of people recovering from a mental illness, and it's amazing the parallels. And I call recovery the gift of the drug and alcohol field and the mental health field. I think that's very true. And I was struck by the discussion with Louise, kind of covering the history of AA. And what struck me about the discussion is I think we all know how inappropriately alcoholism has been treated historically. And the days of the asylum, the days of the institution, and how far, fortunately, we progressed. And AA was, I think, the major breakthrough in helping people understand that it was a whole wrong approach. Today we recognize that, you know, they are separate diseases. They are different diseases. But it's amazing to me that today it's almost as if now there's been a connect with the concept of recovery and what we can learn about recovery. In America's landscape, there are 22.2 million people with a serious substance abuse problem. That's drug and alcohol problem. There are 19.6 million Americans with a serious mental illness. And there are 4.2 million Americans with co-occurring serious mental illness and substance abuse disorders. This is data we've never really had before, but through our household survey, we're able to verify this over just the past few years. And the thing we've got to keep in mind as we talk about how do we address this issue in our country is the fact that all the individuals we talk about are people first, are people with hopes and fears, people with lives to get on with, people with families and jobs, and above all, people who can live and live well despite having a chronic illness. We need to recognize that and we need to recognize that we need to be held accountable to operationalize and to put into action what we know. The way I put it is we know more today than ever before. We've heard from Keith, Louise, the more and more that we know today. And again, AA has been developing this for 70 years, and maybe now we can, as science becomes even better at understanding things, we can explain more about why AA's worked, which I think is just a remarkable, and it's one of those aha moments as we continue to go on. Truth that you know from your own experience, but when science can verify the truth you know, it just strengthens the message to be able to communicate that in a wider spectrum. And what strikes me is the fact that we know more today than ever before, so we need to be held accountable, all of us. And that includes those of us in government, those of us in science, those of us in academia. We need to be held accountable to do what we know and to do what we know works, and that's a challenge. Even though AA has been talking about recovery since 1935, in 2001 when I first came to SAMHSA, not many people were just beginning to talk about recovery. I do consider myself in recovery from being a mental health and substance abuse provider. I call myself a recovering provider now that I'm a government official. But in that role, I also understand how challenging it is to make sure we're doing the right things and to make sure we're relevant. And actually, it's from that experience of being a provider that I began to understand recovery. Now, my first job right out of school, young, left behind the ear social worker, was in Foster, Ohio. And it was with a mental health center. And my first focus was working with people who had serious mental illness coming out of state hospitals and going to the community. And I remember asking them a question in an aftercare group. And I ran an aftercare group of about 12 to 13 people who were trying to find their way in a community. And many of these individuals had been struck down, literally, by a mental illness. Many of them late teens, early 20s, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. And back in those days, as you know, and well, 25 years ago and then before, it wasn't unusual for people to have spent years, decades, in a state hospital. And they're being brought out of the state hospital. And I remember asking them the question, what do you need? What do you need? As we take a look. Now, what's interesting to me is none of them said they needed a program. None of them said they needed a psychiatrist. None of them said they needed a psychologist. None of them even said they needed a social worker, which I didn't understand, but I accepted. But what they said was they needed a job, a home, and this is a quote, a date on the weekend, but connectedness to family, to friends, to community. And those are the three things I kept hearing. In Pennsylvania, part of my tenure, I was responsible for the 10 state hospitals, and I would go and spend the night in a state hospital. I would get better information when I spent the night at the state hospital. Because I found out when you're in charge of the state hospitals, you go during the day, they feed you pretty good food. They roll up the red carpet, and everyone's telling you how great they are. But when you spend the night with the patients in the wards, you learn all sorts of things. But I would ask the question, what do you need there? And this is what struck me. The answer I get throughout my whole career is the same. People talk in terms of goals in their life, what they want in their day-to-day life. And they want relationship with family and friends. They want a job, a home. And a quote, I keep hearing that theme, a day on the weekend. People want that special someone in their life. They want special people in their life. They need connectedness and relationship. So our vision at SAMHSA that we developed is based on that. And our vision is simply stated, a life in the community for everyone. Individuals that are trapped in addiction are individuals who many times coming out of their addiction find themselves living on the fringes, trying to find recovery. We find this with people with serious mental illness as well. And we find this with people who are both in addiction and a mental illness that they're struggling with in their lives. And it's a vision that cannot be realized until people that are dealing with those illnesses are able to find interventions, find supports, but most importantly, build hope, learn how to manage their illness and then manage their life, and learn how to begin to recover. And it will not be fulfilled, that vision, until the people we're responsible for are finding that safe, decent place to live, are finding that connectedness to family and friends, and are finding a life in the community. Two books that have impacted me as we think about conceptualizing recovery, and also we think about our own responsibility wherever we find ourselves of what we need to fulfill. The one thing these two books have in common is they all start out with one sentence that says a lot in that one sentence. And if you only read the first sentence in these two books, it gives you a lot to think about. The first book is The Road Less Traveled by Dr. Scott Peck. And the first sentence in that book is, life is difficult. Life is difficult. And he goes on to say that until you accept the fact life is difficult, life will never be easy. If you begin to assume life should be easy, then you're going to be disappointed. You're going to be frustrated. But life is difficult. And a lot of living life and living it successfully is learning how to handle and address those difficulties and expecting those difficulties and having then the tools necessary to begin to address it. The other book is a more recent book called The Purpose-Driven Life. And the first sentence in The Purpose-Driven Life is, it's not about you. It's not about you. And I often thought, if you think about those two sentences, life is difficult and it's not about you, you begin to understand the first couple steps on the road to recovery when you begin to put that in context. And I think it's really critical for those of us as we look at, if we really want to be relevant as government programs, to address addiction in our society and to address mental illness in our society, we have to take into account those goals, those aspirations, and those facts of life. And how do we begin to operationalize recovery? How do we begin to operationalize what we do? Well, one thing we're trying to do in SAMHSA is articulating our vision of life in the community for everyone. We also have changed our mission statement. And our mission, our traditional mission statement, is to assure access to quality assessment, treatment, and prevention services. Well, that's still a core part of our mission. But we now rephrased our mission to what we need to be doing in our country is building resilience and facilitating recovery. The government needs at least to be getting out of the way of assuring recovery gets facilitated instead of maybe sometimes getting in the way. So we need to examine that. So what we're trying to do as we move ahead, both on the addiction side as well as the mental health side, is to take a look at transforming our systems of care to be recovery-oriented in what we do. And the first thing we're doing is identifying our performance measures. In other words, instead of the only way we assess whether a program is doing what it's supposed to do, does it meet certification standards, does it meet, you know, those types of things. And those things are important for public safety and public health standpoint. We need to be measuring, are the people that are receiving care under programs we're funding, are they getting that job? Are they getting that home? Are they getting that date on the weekends? I'm not saying government should get into dating services, but are they getting connected to family and friends? And actually, the outcome measures that we have now are employment, education. The outcome measures we have are stabilized housing and living situation. The outcome measures we're using now are connectedness to community, family, friends, to structures within the community, engagement with AA, for example, the community support groups being part of that, knowing that those three outcome measures are very critical to see whether we're succeeding or not. And if we begin to hold ourselves accountable as government and how we're spending taxpayer dollars on holding ourselves accountable to outcomes and having the outcomes up and down the line, and we base those outcomes on recovery, I think we can have a profound impact. Other outcome measures I might mention are involvement with the criminal justice system. We have many individuals coming out of the criminal justice system. 80% of the people in our state prisons have a drug and or alcohol issue, and over 50% were under the influence at the time of arrest. What we're finding is when people receive treatment, when people receive intervention, even if it's forced, and if they're in prison, you can pretty well force treatment. What we find is that people attain the same recovery if they get out and they don't recommit. And that's what the facts are telling us. So that tells us we need a strong partnership with criminal justice in order to address these issues. And then the final three domains that we're looking at is the client perception of care, client satisfaction, cost effectiveness, and are we really funding those things that are working and holding ourselves accountable. I mentioned earlier that the President talked about addiction in his 2003 State of the Union. Access to Recovery is the program that was unveiled, and SAMHSA is held accountable to operationalize and implement Access to Recovery. It's based on a voucher program, and we have made awards to 14 states and one tribal organization to begin implementing it. And it's to basically say that there are many pathways to recovery. There's not just one treatment protocol. There's not just one way to do it. That if you have 200 people in a room in recovery, you have 200 different stories about how people attain their recovery, some common elements, and you articulate those elements very well in AA, what those common elements are, what we can learn. But we need to be thinking in terms of how people can chart their own course to recovery and have choices. And that's what Access to Recovery is about. For the first time, we have in place a program that funds services around the needs of the individual, not around the needs of bureaucracies or a protocol. In Wisconsin, we implemented Access to Recovery in December and issued the first Access to Recovery voucher to a 41-year-old mother from Milwaukee whose addiction and related felony conviction had become roadblocks to getting a job and raising her children. This single mother chose an agency which provides residential clinical treatment and recovery support services that will allow her one-year-old baby to live with her in treatment once she's ready for reunification. And she worked with her Access to Recovery coordinator to develop her own recovery support team, which includes her service provider, her probation officer, church members, family members, and others to help her achieve and then sustain recovery. She recently used the analogy of an angel on her shoulder when she described the services that she's receiving. Our nation's faith-based and community-based providers do offer a life net for people in need and people searching for services that save lives. And AA is essential. Now, while AA does not receive funding, and you don't want funding, you made that clear. That's another reason I agreed to come to this conference. You are the first and only conference I come to that doesn't ask me for money, so I'll keep coming back. But Access to Recovery can actually augment your efforts because they can issue the state and the entity that issues vouchers can issue transportation vouchers. So if someone is having trouble because they don't have access to transportation and they want to go to an AA meeting, they could get issued a transportation voucher if that's a problem for them, if they're in a remote area or an area that they need some help. So that's not really supporting you, but it's supporting the individual to obtain the help you have to offer. So I think there are ways we can partner without compromising your values and how you do business, because what you do works. What you do works. And the first goal of government should be do no harm. And we don't want to do any harm to the work that you're doing. But we also want to find other appropriate ways we can support you encourage you in what you're doing. There are also several types of peer services offered through the Recovery Community Services Program that we fund through SAMHSA. Peer-led recovery support groups and meetings, alcohol-free, drug-free, social and recreational activities, to name a few. And the more we can offer, especially people who are first embarking on their road to recovery, opportunities and activities that are alcohol-free and augment peer support services, I think that's an important thing to offer to help people. Before I close, I also want to briefly talk about the importance of prevention. And that's another aspect that we're focused on at SAMHSA. And I know back in the days when Elaine was there, prevention was a major part of the agenda, and more we're learning about what works with prevention. In 2003, about 10.9 million young people ages 12 to 20 reported current alcohol use. 11 million youth. That is almost 30% of all children and youth in that age bracket. One-third. Of them, nearly 7.2 million were binge drinkers. That's five or more drinks in one sitting. 2.3 million were heavy drinkers. That's five or more drinks in one sitting and having five sittings within a month. And they drank even though they know all underage drinking is illegal and also dangerous. But we also know that it's never too early to begin educating about the dangers of underage alcohol use. For example, more than one quarter of alcohol-dependent adults aged 21 or older in 2003 had first used alcohol before age 14. Over 80% had first used before they were 18, and 96% had first used before age 21. So we're not sure we know the why yet. We are getting there. But we know the what, and the data is actually rather remarkable, that if you can prevent consumption of alcohol before the age of 21, it begins to improve the odds of success in that individual's life that they won't become addicted to alcohol. So again, that tells us it's real critical for us to have a prevention agenda. And we're studying that what. So we need to be very, very focused on the youth today. And when we see that, primarily, unfortunately, when youth do drink, they binge drink, and they drink heavily, it also sets them up in terms of all sorts of consequences physically for their future. We formed an interagency coordinating committee on the prevention of underage drinking. It's conducted a thorough review of existing federal efforts and identified opportunities for collaboration. And so for the first time, we will be submitting a report to Congress, and we're looking to have a national strategy in addressing underage drinking in the United States. to make sure it's talked about, it's looked at. We've made progress on other illicit drugs. Illicit drug use actually is down the past 5 years by 17%. Illicit alcohol use among youth has remained stubbornly the same. It's not going down. So that's why we need a strategy. We need to address it. Also, we're working with the Ad Council in coming up with some public service announcements to help empower parents to be able to address this issue with their youth. And we also have a Reach Out Now effort in which we send materials to every fifth grade and sixth grade class in this country to talk about alcohol in the classroom and the dangers of alcohol use. We need to reach down to the earliest ages before they're in that category of actually binge drinking. I'd like to end my remarks with a quote. A challenge for me 10 years ago when I was in Pennsylvania was thinking about how do we begin to talk about recovery in a public policy way, in a governmental way, in a way of making it relevant to what we do. And how do we begin to talk about recovery on the mental health side of the equation, and what have we learned from the substance abuse side that we could bring to the mental health side? Well, I came across a quote from an individual which struck me as helping me conceptualize that. It's a quote from General Douglas MacArthur. Now, MacArthur is not a recovery advocate that I'm aware of. But MacArthur spoke the truth when he said, in the central place of every heart, there's a recording chamber. So long as it receives a message of beauty, hope, cheer, and courage, so long are you young. When the wires are all down, and your heart is covered with the snows of pessimism and the ice of cynicism, then and only then are you grown old. And if these words of MacArthur are true, then the person trapped in addiction, the youth beginning to drink or use drugs, beginning on a downward spiral, these are individuals who become more and more cut off, more and more isolated, who truly do have all the wires down and in many ways grow old before their time. This then tells us that once intervention begins to take hold, once the wires start to come up, we must do everything within our capacities to assure messages are sent to that central place of the heart. Messages which convey beauty, hope, cheer, and courage. For when those messages come through and ring true, they melt away the snows of pessimism. They melt away the ice of cynicism. They melt away a glacier of despair. This, then, invites recovery. This, then, is where we need to continue to be partners in recovery, supporting you to do what you do, recognizing that you are the message, and that there is no better message or messenger than you. Thank you so much for all you do, and may God bless.
Wow, those were just three wonderful, wonderful talks from our friends. And who knows, maybe our future Class A is somewhere down the line. But please join me in thanking Keith, Louise, and Charles for this lovely, lovely talk. Thank you. And I want to remind you, we still have some more time. There's some time for some questions if you have them. But also want to remind you that the CDs and audio tapes of these meetings, of this meeting especially, will be available at the Tate Sales Booth in Hall E of the Convention Center. So we have about 15 minutes left, and I know that Charles, Louise, and Keith would be very happy to respond to any questions. And I can see that we're doing it in the AA way. We lined up at the mic. Okay, and let's begin there with the center mic.
Okay. Hello, I'm Janet, and I'm an alcoholic.
Okay.
And I'm currently from Danet Carpenter from 08814 Area 03 in Arizona, Scottsdale, Arizona. Formerly from Boston, where I got sober. But I particularly, hey Boston, I particularly still talk like a Bostonian. I was interested in what you said, Charles, and I thank you. You look familiar. I've probably seen you at some conferences. And I recently had the opportunity to spend a couple of years working with co-occurring and severely mentally ill, and the value of what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is something that I could never have gotten in the field, which is the place where when I look at somebody with schizophrenia and they're so sick And I know I have that spark of hope that I got here that they can recover. And I carry that. And being in Arizona, I think it's a newer field than Boston. I didn't work with severe mentally ill. I worked with addiction in Boston and alcoholism. And I'm 15 years in the field. And it seemed like it was a concept that you talked about housing and you talked about work. And those are very valuable. What I learned from my sponsor very early on was to get sober. Like, she wouldn't hear anything else except to get sober. And I know you gave the number, 4% are co-occurring. And where I just worked, which is Maricopa County, you know, the whole system, it's like 85% of the severely mentally ill are substance abusing. They gave that quote. And every time I touched someone's life, I saw recovery available that I got from Alcoholics Anonymous, the hope that I got here. And it wasn't about housing, and it wasn't about a job. It was about if they could stop drinking and get sober, like my sponsor taught me, then we could do the rest of the stuff easily. And, you know, they've got this whole housing first deal. But we put them in housing, and they have a place to drink. It was just, so I just, I mean, it really, so I just, I know I'm going to finish, but I just feel like, there's a vision there, and I know Patricia Deegan's work, and there is a vision of recovery. And everyone, it was a miracle day after day going into work and watching people go into treatment because that hope that I knew I had that I carried to another individual because of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Thank you very much for sharing.
Yes.
We need to move a little bit more quickly because we just have a few minutes, so I want everyone to have an opportunity to answer, ask their questions. Sorry.
Thank you. My name is Sharon W.
Can you come up to the microphone a little bit more?
My name is Sharon W. I'm an alcoholic in recovery, 24 years. I've worked in the field for 15 years, 14 of them at Bellwood here in Toronto. I have two things to suggest in terms of helping people in recovery. One, when you do your research and you give money for funding for your treatment centers, one thing is that you should ensure while they're in the in-treatment phase of the recovery that when they get out, they have names and numbers of AA groups that they can contact wherever they're being taken out to. I had the pleasure of conducting two longitudinal outcome studies. And what was resounding, what blew every other variable out of the water, is the support that a person will put around themselves once they post-treatment. It didn't matter the type of regular support, so AA. The other thing I would like to suggest, there are many people who are in recovery that choose to work in this field. I think that when people in recovery have a special gift to offer when they are working in this field, and I think it should be recognized. I think they should be offered education when they're working in their field to learn about the other side, about mental health issues, research issues, schooling, the things that will help them do their job better. I just went through an experience not too long ago where about 15 men in a detox were redeployed. They were not offered the education. Lawsuits followed and whatnot. But what I'm saying is this should be something that the federal government can put in place to help people that are working in the field, that are in recovery, and also people who go to treatment who need the support after they get out. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. Thank you. Okay.
My name's Richard, and I'm an alcoholic. When I came into the program in the early 70s, I had a friend who was in Scientology, and he tried to get me interested, and I said, no, I found AA. So my question, and before I got into AA, some of us went to Synanon, which was a drug program. So my question is, and I'm very curious, just how effective have these programs been, Scientology and Synanon, in helping drug addicts and alcoholics?
Anybody want to answer that? There's no single study that would respond to the question that you just raised. They're not aware of a single study that would respond to that, unfortunately. But thank you for the question. Okay.
Hi, I'm Sue. I'm an alcoholic from Ithaca, New York. And my home group is on an Ivy League campus there, if you know it. But I got sober there, and one of the things that's really amazing to me is to find out that over the last couple of years, many of the students are coming into college already have gone through recovery. And that's the really good news. I have a lot of beautiful students who come to our home group and are amazing in spreading the message. But the other problem I see there, and I'm not really sure how to address it, my sponsor says I get up on my high horse, and maybe I should have some humility. But the health professionals on campus talk more about behavioral issues with drinking than recovery and AA at all. I mean, they don't even really, as far as I could tell, and I've researched it, discuss the disease of alcoholism. And over the last couple of years, we've had several alcohol-related deaths, suicides, and also students being expelled because of their drinking habits. And, you know, these are brilliant, beautiful students who are being accepted into a college that's very, very competitive. And to see them suffer like that and, you know, not get the help they need is really frustrating for me. So I'd like to know if you know about college-age programs that are going on that help. I know that there's things called sober houses at some colleges, and if you know anything about that and how AA can help.
Anyone want to just talk about? Okay. Keith?
Thanks for bringing that up. I actually just found out, I was at SAMHSA for a meeting last month, and that there are now sober dorms at a couple of universities, and I believe Texas Christian is one of them, where people, students in recovery come back, live together, support each other, and go through the program together, and their grades and their graduation rates are higher than the other students at the university, which is really remarkable. So appreciate you bringing that up. So.
Thank you, Keith. Yes, sir.
My name is Yannick. I'm an alcoholic. I've attended kind of a book seminar where they kind of throw out a proposition. They say this is not part of AA, but you might as well get to know something about alcohol. And they put out a proposition that says that the alcoholic processes alcohol differently in the body than non-alcoholics, and that it stays in a certain state longer for alcoholics. Is this true? Is this something that you've found in research as well?
Thank you for the question. Keith is going to respond.
That's probably too simple description that was given you, but it is true that the way our body breaks up alcohol, we have an enzyme that breaks into different parts, and people vary about how quickly they can do that. And some people, when they drink, it's incredibly unpleasant because their body can't break it down. And so if you're in that situation, which is a common gene found in like Han Chinese and some Native Americans have it as well, alcohol is so unpleasant that you're at lower risk to drink just because it feels so bad. It's too simple. I don't know exactly what was said, but it's too simple to say alcoholics process alcohol one way and it's totally different. There's no overlap. But most of these things are matters of degree.
So. Let me just say I'll try to get to all of you if you're very brief. And also, they're available at the end if we don't get all the questions answered right here. Yes, sir.
My name is Denny. I am an alcoholic. Thank you, Dr. Nadeau, Dr. Humphrey, and Mr. Curry. I experienced some antipathy coming in here this morning because I sometimes think that science is going to explain away the mystery of recovery. And I value the mystery. I heard a speaker in Fort Wayne, Indiana, who said that he does not speak for his higher power, nor is he comfortable around those who do. I agree with him. And when there is something that I do not understand in my own personal recovery, I simply say, I don't understand this. I do not attribute it to any other thing. The other thing I would like to say is that Claude G., at my home group meeting, says that he believes on some deep level that he has chosen this disease. And I cannot prove that I have chosen this disease, but that idea appeals to me because then I can take responsibility for it.
Thank you for sharing. Yes, sir.
Good morning. My name is Gary. I'm an alcoholic from Detroit, Michigan. And I found this very enlightening because before today I thought I was the only Republican social worker on the planet. I don't really have a question. I have more of a comment. I recently took a position with a health maintenance organization that does screening and assessment and referral for underinsured people or no insurance. And I want to thank you for the government funding for block grants and Medicaid to put them in treatment. But the biggest problem I'm discovering with that is my coworkers lack the knowledge and sensitivity to be working with drug addicts and alcoholics. and they have a very condescending attitude, and many of them look for excuses to deny access to treatment. So my suggestion is that you try to implement some programs that would give some sensitivity training to these health maintenance organizations that are spending your wonderful money. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Rainey. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. And I wanted just to ask or to speak a little bit about a study that's been done by Kaiser Permanente and the CDC, which is the Adverse Childhood Experience Study, which correlates adverse early childhood experiences like physical and sexual abuse, neglect, children witnessing violence, to death-making diseases such as alcoholism, and this notion of violence being linked to addiction. What happens is the act of violence occurs, there's a change in the brain chemistry. This is a study of 17,000 Kaiser Permanente people, so it's a pretty significant study. So change in the brain chemistry, what happens is there's a coping strategy that happens. Some of us become alcoholics, and that leads to death. And I think that this integration of this of violence and the lives of early children integrated with an understanding of how to work with addicts is really incredibly important. I know SAMHSA's doing some significant work in this area, and I guess later on I'll ask Dr. Humphreys what his thinking is on this. And Louise, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Barrie, Ontario. I just want to reflect on what you're talking about in prevention, and something that I'm not a professional, but I thought you might want to consider, is when you're talking about the hardcore drugs and the alcohol, the thing that we have to understand is, growing up in our culture, it is a culture. And, you know, the hardcore part isn't. And when you're young, I don't know if you looked into that, but, and I've done a lot of thinking about it lately too, is AA for me, it's our culture. And then there is that culture, and until you break that, you're going to really have a problem.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yes, good morning, everyone. My name is Arnello, and I'm a recovered alcoholic, and I'm also a licensed clinical social worker, which I usually don't mention at AA meetings. But, you know, I just like to, you know, I just think, like, everyone would really benefit incredibly if both, you know, professionals, alcoholics in the field of alcoholism and non-alcoholics would benefit incredibly if they took a little time to learn about, like, the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and what traditional recovery is really all about. As a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a professional in the field, I always have to make a distinction between what my role is as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and what my role is as a professional in the field of alcoholism. And I can't wear both those hats at the same time. And, you know, I don't know. I feel like there's really a distinction between treatment and recovery. You know, that treatment is therapy, you know, and recovery is a spiritual process. And they, you know, they both serve, like, a good purpose, but they're two different things entirely,
okay, well,
you know.
Great. Thank you for that comment. And I think Charles would like to respond to you. Okay.
I completely agree with that. I think there is a dissatic recovery is more the process of what really happens in an individual's life as they begin to learn how to manage their illness and then manage their life. And treatment is more of, it's a protocol, it's a program, it's an intervention. But the goal is that we should really examine funding only those treatments which facilitate recovery, or that there's a link to it, because I think for too long there's been too much of a wall. But I appreciate what you're saying, because we can't confuse the two and should not confuse the two. Thank you.
I'm Shira. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and a master addictions counselor. I see clients in both Delaware and Pennsylvania, and at one point I was a contractor in a psychiatric practice, and their belief system said that if we can take care of the depression and the marriage and the kids, are, you know, then they won't need to drink. They could not accept addiction as a primary diagnosis. I could talk myself blue in the face, and I finally gave up and said, well, that's not my problem. I do a lot of EAP work. Working with EAP connections is very rewarding because they also are on the same page as we are. and they understand that clients are going to lose their jobs if they don't get into recovery. I generally make no bones about my own recovery. Many people don't recognize that you can be a white female with a job and that, you know, it's okay. And if I had to have a disease, I'd just as soon have this one because it's the only disease I know of, but we don't have to take anything to get help and get better. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, again, we certainly want to thank our friends of Alcoholics Anonymous for coming and sharing with us this morning. And certainly want to thank all of you all for your participation. And if you would care to join me in closing this meeting with the Serenity Prayer, please.